Hi, and welcome to the Canvas Church Podcast, where you can listen to our weekly sermons. Thanks for joining us on this journey as we look to God's Word to mold us into people becoming the church.
Amen. All right, well, I've been pretty excited to jump into part three of our Hope Restored, How Jesus Provides Where Other Promises Fail series. And this morning you'll see that we've titled this message, The Irreligious, The Irreligious. And our goal has been real simple throughout this series. It's just this. It's to recognize how putting our ultimate faith or our ultimate hope in anything other than Jesus will leave us wanting at best, but more than likely it will leave us anxious, angry, bitter, lonely, confused. Like, putting our hope in any other gospel, by gospel just simply mean a set of ideas or beliefs, a promise, if you will, that we're pursuing after because this promise has said it's going to pay off dividends in the end. And we all are chasing different promises. We have our eyes focused on different things. But we need to know right out of the gate, we've been talking about this since Easter, is that putting our ultimate hope in any other gospel or any other person or any other thing than Jesus Christ will leave us wanting at best. But there's a whole bunch of other things that come along with it. Again, like anxiousness and anger and bitterness and loneliness and all of that, right? It's a big old mixed bag. And I really don't have to say that for you to recognize it because we've all lived enough life in this place to know we have bought a promise that in the end didn't pay off. We pursued a promise, and in the end, we were left wanting when it was all said and done. And as I prepared for today's message, it got me thinking about etiquette. Etiquette's an interesting thing, isn't it? Etiquette, this set of rules, oftentimes they're unspoken. You don't know that you broke them until you broke them, and then everybody that you're around look at you like, what are you doing? Anybody been in that predicament before? Like, you broke some etiquette rules, and you're like, whoa, clearly I just did something wrong. I am definitely on the outside looking in at this point. Like, there are so many different environments where we find etiquette at play. There's a few that I engage in, have a good time. One of them is hiking. Maybe you didn't know this, but if you're hiking, there's a ton of etiquette that comes along with hiking. Like, leave no trace. You'd think that'd be a no-brainer, but for some, you know, it's like Hansel and Gretel, you know? They're like, I'm not sure I'm going to find my way back, so I just leave a trail along the way as I go. Another etiquette when it comes to hiking is if you're walking uphill, or excuse me, if you're coming downhill, and there's somebody coming up a hill, that if you're coming down the hill, that you give way to the person going up the hill. Did you guys know that? It's true. Yeah, you give way to them. It's just etiquette. Let them by. Like, they're doing the harder grind right now. They're headed uphill. And, you know, I have this thing about me. I have a pretty good way of letting people around me know that they're doing the wrong thing just by the look. Maybe you have this. It's actually a gift, I think. So if I'm, like, charging up a hill and somebody's coming down and they don't give way on the trail, they don't get out of the way, give them one of these, like, yeesh, you know, just like let them know they're just a bit out of place, you know. It's just a gift that I have. Another thing that I didn't even realize when I jumped into this sport, how much etiquette there was involved. I got a clue of it when I was told, do not wear jeans and a t-shirt. And thankfully they told me because I would have shown up and felt very out of place, but it's the game of golf. Golf, there is a lot of etiquette. It is a very anxious-inducing sport. Especially when you first get into it. I mean, there is a lot of unspoken rules when it comes to golf. One is you better be in a collared shirt. Except for nowadays, apparently there's like this mock collared shirt that you can wear. You're going to be okay. But do not go out in jeans or shorts and flip-flops. Not a thing, okay, on the golf course. You don't want to do that. And I learned this stuff as I went. And oftentimes it was because I found myself in a situation where I felt very out of place. I felt like I was on the outside looking in. Like, if you get on the green and everybody's ball is on the green, you do not walk through somebody else's path to the hole. I didn't realize that until I did it, and they're looking at me like, what? They gave me one of the looks that I give other people. Yeah, it was not very nice. And there's things you said, like if you're wearing a hat on the 18th hole, once you guys all putt out and you're done, you take your hat off and you shake the people's hands that you were golfing with. I didn't know that that was a thing until I saw that take place. Like, etiquette is such an interesting thing. Etiquette is like this, these list of rules, again, whether they're spoken or unspoken, there's these list of rules that keep people who aren't supposed to be there out, keep you on the outside. And if you find yourself on the in and you don't know the rules, you sure feel like you are on the outside looking in. I think that's what etiquette is meant to do. Like, that is the whole purpose of etiquette. Now, interesting, in the same way, there are rules and regulations that govern our, or these could be spoken or unspoken, that govern our gospels as well. And by gospels, remember, we're talking about a set of principles or a set of ideas that we've put our ultimate hope in. We said for the last several weeks that everybody is pursuing a gospel. We've all bought a promise somewhere along the way, and we are in pursuit of that promise, hoping that it's going to pay off for us. Timothy Keller, he says he can boil all of our gospels or our idols or our counterfeit gods down into four things: comfort, approval, power, or control. Like, whatever we're pursuing after, if you burrow down deep enough, you're going to find one of those four things that we're in pursuit of. And those gospels, whatever one we're pursuing, they have rules associated with them as well. There is etiquette to those gospels, and you will find yourself on the outside looking in if you cross the line. No matter what we're putting our ultimate hope in, there is a set of rules along the way. Let me give you an example of what I mean. Let's say that your gospel or the ultimate hope, the thing you're putting your ultimate hope in, is comfort. Comfort in this life. It's having things, it's having stuff, it's making this life right now, treating it as if this is heaven itself. So you, at all costs, you want to make this world, this life, as comfortable as absolutely possible. There are rules that govern that gospel. And we know this, we have it wrapped up in a saying, and you're all going to recognize this saying and what it means when I say it. Because we're all familiar with the rule. And here is the rule that governs that pursuit. Keep up with the Joneses. Keep up with the Joneses. Like, if comfort is going to be the ultimate thing you put your hope in, then you have to keep up with the Joneses. If somebody has something a little bit nicer than you, then, well, you have to level up, don't you? If they have technology that's a bit outside of your technology, it's a little bit better, well, then you too have to get that technology. The car's a little bit nicer, then you got to get a nicer car, right? And it's this constant jockeying for comfort, having the best of the best of the best. Or how about this? Here's another example. What if you're putting your ultimate hope in people's approval? Well, man, that's a challenging one, isn't it? Putting your ultimate hope in other people's approval. Like, the rules that govern other people's approval is as finicky as the people you're putting your hope in. And us people, we are finicky, aren't we? Here's how the game kind of plays out in your mind. I know this because I am this. Like, my default mode, my default God that I pursue is other people's approval. It's what I run after if I'm not running after Jesus. And here's the mind games, in case approval's not a thing that you deal with. Here's the kind of mind games that you play in your mind. The rules that govern a people pleaser's mind. If somebody says something to you like, hey, you did a great job at that, your mind doesn't go to like, oh, I'm glad they thought I did a good job. Like, oh, they're probably saying I did a good job because I probably didn't do a good job, and they're just overcompensating to make me feel better in this moment. Anybody else have that problem? Yeah, just weird games. Or they'll say something like, hey, you're way better at that than you used to be, and you don't think about the progress that you made. You think about, like, how bad was I before? Like, when you're seeking people's approval, you don't take compliments. You take them as, like, they're telling you you did something wrong before. Like, that's the game that you play inside of your mind and all of these rules that govern these different gospels that we run after. They end up leaving us on the outside looking in. They end up separating us. But this morning, I got good news for you, and it's the good news of the true gospel. Again, gospel is anything that you put your hope and your trust in, and the scriptures give us the true gospel. And here is the hope of the true gospel, the good news, is your badness doesn't keep you out. Your badness doesn't keep you out. Now, I say this is good news, and you need to know this is absolutely good news because I did something this morning. I looked at all of you, and I was trying to find one of you that was good. I couldn't find one. All of us, like everybody that I looked at today, none of us are good. We all make it into the bad category. And the first person that I saw today was myself. I looked in the mirror and I said, "You ain't good." So this is great news. This isn't just a cliche statement. This isn't just a cliche saying. This is incredibly good news that we're going to hear from the scriptures today, is that your badness doesn't keep you out. And for some of you this morning, you're sitting there on the outside of Christianity and you haven't surrendered your life to Jesus because what's playing in your mind is, if you only knew what I have done. If you knew what I had done, you would know that God could never forgive me. Friend, what you need to hear this morning, and what I hope rattles around in your brain until it gets rooted into your heart, is this: your badness doesn't keep you out. We're going to see this in Luke chapter 15. We're going to be in verse 11. As you turn there, let me catch you up to speed. Chapter 15 of Luke has three different parables. And these three different parables are stories with intent. They're meant to teach us something along the way. And these three parables are meant to be read together. And what happens is Jesus had quite a following around him at this point in his ministry. And there was a lot of disreputable sinners. There was a lot of irreligious people that Jesus was magnetizing. They were drawn to him in the way that he taught. They were drawn to him because he fed like thousands of people with a small bit of resources. Like, he did some incredible things, and there was lots of people that were drawn to him. And the religious rulers of the day, the religious of the day, saw all of the irreligious going towards Jesus, and they did not like it at all. They're like, if this guy was any sort of a religious leader, he would know that these people are too far outside of God's reach. And because Jesus knew that they were thinking these things and saying these things, he begins to teach them, and he teaches them with three parables. The first one is the parable of the lost sheep, where Jesus says that the shepherd, the good shepherd, leaves the 99 sheep who are found, and he goes after the one lost sheep. Not to scold the lost sheep, not to beat the lost sheep, but to pick it up, stick it on his shoulders, and carry it back to the family. The point of the lost sheep is there is no 99. Every one of us, because we are all bad sinners, we are the one. We are the one that Jesus is in pursuit of. He's running after us. And for many of us in this room or those listening online, we have been found. Like, we have surrendered our lives to Jesus. He literally picked us up, put us on his shoulders, and carried us back into the family. If you're here and you have not yet surrendered your life to Jesus, you are still the one. And I'm pretty convinced that you're here this morning, not by accident, but because Jesus is in pursuit of you to carry you back home with him. And his desire and our desire is to see you surrender your life to Jesus today. So that's the parable of the lost sheep. And then he goes on, because not every one of his listeners would have been familiar with farming, and maybe they weren't all shepherds, right? So he gets straight down to the heart of thing. Like, if you had 10 very valuable coins, one was lost, wouldn't you do everything that you could to go find the one? Like, wouldn't you light all of the lamps, sweep all of the corners? Like, you would do spring cleaning on your house to find that one coin. How much more important is it for heaven to celebrate one sinner who repents and gives their life to Jesus? And then it goes on, as we're going to see here, he goes on to illustrate the point even further, and we pick it up in verse 11. It says this: to illustrate the point further, Jesus told them this story. A man had two sons. The younger son told his father, "I want my share of your estate now before you die." So his father agreed to divide his wealth between his sons. A few days later, this younger son packed all his belongings and he moved to a distant land, and there he wasted all his money in wild living. About the time his money ran out, a great famine swept over the land and he began to starve. He persuaded a local farmer to hire him, and the man sent him into his field to feed pigs. Jesus uses this illustration very pointedly. Jewish people were not allowed to be around pigs. Like, he is trying to illustrate that this is the lowest of the lowest rung on the ladder. He could not, if there is a bottom of the barrel, he fell through it. Like, he is in the bottom pit. So he's out in the field feeding pigs. In verse 16, the young man became so hungry that even the pods he was feeding the pigs looked good to him, but no one gave him anything. When he finally came to his senses, he said to himself, "At home, even the hired servants have food enough to spare, and here I am dying of hunger. I will go home to my father and say, 'Father, I have sinned against both heaven and you, and I am no longer worthy of being called your son. Please take me on as a hired servant.' So he returned home to his father, and while he was still a long way off, his father saw him coming, and filled with love and compassion, he ran to his son. He embraced him. He kissed him. He said to him, his son said to him, 'Father, I have sinned against both heaven and you, and I am no longer worthy of being called your son.' But his father said to the servants, 'Quick, bring the finest robe in the house, put it on him. Get a ring for his finger and sandals for his feet. And kill the calf we have been fattening. We must celebrate with a feast, for this son of mine was dead and has now returned to life. He was lost, but now he is found.' So the party began." I love this story. It's one of my favorites in all of Scripture, this prodigal son, which really ends up being two prodigal sons, and we're going to talk about the older son next week, but let's dive into the younger son this week. Timothy Keller, in his book, Prodigal God, he points out that generally speaking, human beings, we try to find fulfillment, contentment, and happiness one of two ways, and for a lot of us, it ends up crossing over. We try both ways along the way. Number one way we try to find it is through moral conformity. Moral conformity. This is the buttoned up people, right? The suit and jacket, the cross the T's, the dot the I's. If there's a rule, they follow it to a letter. If there's a recipe, they follow it completely as it's laid out in the rest. Like, these are the people. These are the do-gooders, the do-riders. They do no wrong, the best that they can, right? They follow all of the rules. We have some do-gooders in here. I'm one of those people that loves to cross T's and dot I's. Like, I would say later on in life, early on in life, I was definitely not this. Early on in life, I was the other side. But later on in life, I blend towards this moral conformity, right? I want to, by my actions, the stuff that I do right, I should stake my claim, find my fulfillment, find my contentment and happiness. Or the other side of the coin are the people who try to find fulfillment outside of Jesus. They do it through self-discovery. When I think of self-discovery, I wasn't alive during the 60s, but I've heard enough stories about it. The 60s, the wild parties of the 60s, right? This is throw off all restraint, like all authority. You push against it. You want nobody to tell you what to do. You don't oppress me with your rules and regulations. I'm going to do it my way. We all know people like that. Some of us are people like that. Like those are the two different directions that we generally take in this life apart from Christ to find fulfillment, to find contentment, and to find all of our hope. We find it in one of those two, either moral conformity or self-discovery. I will figure out on my own. The younger brother, undoubtedly, he chose the self-discovery route. Like that was his desire. He had an idea. He had bought a promise that if only I could get all that my dad has that I'm supposed to get in the end, man, I could go out and really discover myself. If you want to have a journey through self-discovery, somebody who did it and did it well, had all of the resources to do it, I encourage you, read the book of Ecclesiastes. It's by Solomon, one of the smartest people, probably and richest people to have ever walked the earth. And he gave himself away to self-discovery. And he wrote about it. He journaled about it. It's in the book of Ecclesiastes. Read about it and see how it went for him. Now, the younger brother, he definitely gave himself away to the self-discovery route. I'm going to go carve my own way. My dad's not going to tell me what to do anymore. I'm just going to do this on my own. Now, it cannot be overstated how selfish, disrespectful, and disgraceful this act of self-discovery was. See, the younger brother, by virtue of where he found himself in the family line, he was promised, he was set to inherit 1/3 of his father's resources. Father passes away, younger brother's going to get 1/3 of the resources, the older brother's going to get 2/3 of the resources. Why does the older brother get 2/3 of the resources? Well, because it's his responsibility to carry on the leadership of the family once the father dies. So the younger brother says, Dad, I want a third, I want my share of your resource. I want my stake now. I don't want to wait until you die. And that is the key. In order for a father's estate to get separated to his sons, the father first had to die. The inheritance doesn't get divvied out while the father is still alive. So in essence, the younger brother was demanding his inheritance right now, both in intent and in practice. This is what the younger brother is saying to the father. I want your stuff, and I want nothing to do with you. In fact, I'm fairly annoyed that we have to have this conversation right now. I wish you would have just passed away a long time ago, and I never even had to bring this to your attention. But here we are. My life is wasting away while you keep on living. And I think we just should just cut to the chase. How about you just give me my third of the estate? And I'll go on my merry way, on my self-discovery mode. I'll go do that while you sit here with your older brother and you wait to die. Like, let that sink in. I mean, if you're a parent in here, think about what that conversation looks like. A kid comes to you and says, I just wish you would have died a long time ago, but since you're way more resilient than I ever anticipated. Can I just get your stuff? Because I don't care about you. I just want all of your stuff. I wish you were dead, but since you're alive, can you just give me your stuff? And as I read through that and I processed it and I let it roll around in my brain this week, I thought to myself, how often do we do this to God? How often we just take all of his stuff? We enjoy this world around us, the beauty it has to offer, the resources, wishing that he wasn't butting into the picture at all. In fact, Romans, we're going to study that here as our next series together as a church. Romans makes this very clear in the first chapter. It says, in man's futility, they begin to worship the created rather than the creator. What is Romans trying to tell us is that we as humans, what we say to God all the time is we wish you were dead because we want to have control of our own lives, but thanks for giving us all of your stuff. really grateful for all of this, but I wish that you would take a step back. So it just cannot be overstated how disgraceful, how selfish this demand was from the younger brother. At minimum, this demand should have gotten the younger brother ousted from the family, kicked out of the community with nothing but his life, if he was lucky. There was a provision in the law, you can read about it in Leviticus, I believe it's chapter 24, that this kind of disrespect to the family was a death penalty. Death penalty. Like, that's the way you take care of the younger brothers. But in a dramatic turn of events, God gives in. The father gives in. The father gives in and gives him everything that he asks for. We don't know how he does this. I mean, oftentimes back then, most of their resources and wealth was like inside of land. It was the land that they owned. So the father, in order to give a third of his estate away in cash, like, he had to have done a fire sale, like get rid of a third of the estate, sell it off, give the younger brother, divvy up his inheritance. And that's exactly what the father does. This one act right here would have shocked the whole culture. Whoever heard this would have said, there's no way. The father cannot do that. He cannot give him whatever he wants. He's a spoiled little brat. And then it got me thinking, isn't this exactly what God does for us? Same chapter, Romans chapter 1. Humans, we pursued the created rather than the creator. And what does it say? He says, he turned us over to all of the desires of our hearts. Let us do whatever we wanted to do. Just go after it. Do it. And we've been doing it ever since, haven't we? Just running after whatever we give our hearts away to. Now, this parable is meant to teach us, as all parables do, something about God, something about humanity, and how we should respond. And in this parable, we see several false gospels at play, several false gospels that are being pursued. And I want to spend the rest of our time taking a look at three things that we can learn. Again, parables are like onions. I love parables, not onions. I said I loved onions last week. I love parables. But parables are like onions, meaning they're multi-layered. And they're meant to be read and reread and mulled over and thought about and prayed over. And like, because there is so much truth packed into them. So this morning, we are not covering in the entirety all that can be learned from this parable. But I want to point out three different things that we can learn that I think if we will learn, that we'll all walk out of here and we will be uplifted and built up because of it. So number one is this. Pursuing pleasure doesn't pay off. Like, that is so utterly clear inside of this parable. Pursuing pleasure doesn't pay off. Now, that's not to say pleasure is wrong. Our ability to enjoy things and to enjoy life is a gift from God. There is a group of people out there, ascetics, that think that you just need to have pain and misery your whole life because if you don't have pain and misery, then you're not a holy enough person. Okay, we reject that idea. Our ability to enjoy things is a gift from God. But making pleasure and comfort our ultimate pursuit is a bankrupt endeavor. And we learn that so clearly from the younger brother. What does he do? As soon as his dad cashes him out, in a few short days, like, his bags were packed, he is ready to go. All he needed was cash in hand so that he could pursue whatever pleasure he wanted to. And that's exactly what he did. He goes off to a distant land where nobody knows him to sow his wild oats. That's all he wanted to do. And in the end, what does it say? When he finally came to his senses, when he finally realized this complete abandoned pursuit of pleasure could not pay off in the end. When he came to his senses, when he realized that he had bought a lie, that there was a promise made that all you have to do, man, is get some money, get to a distant land, and then you will live your best life now. Like, that was the promise he bought, and he realized in short time it was a bankrupt endeavor. Some of us here today, we are still in that pursuit, in that comfort pursuit, like whatever I can do to make this life the most pleasurable, then I will finally have contentment and fulfillment. I will finally be happy. You've got to hear me this morning. That is a bankrupt endeavor. We can learn that. Pursuing pleasure doesn't pay off. Materialism or comfort and pleasure, it is the air we breathe today as a society, isn't it? None of us are completely inoculated from it. All of us have the temptation to fall into materialism in the pursuit of things in order to satisfy our deepest longing. All of us have that proclivity, but some of us, it has become our ultimate focus. And one of the ways that you can tell if it's your focus or not your focus is just look at how you spend your resources, your time, your money, and your effort. Look at how you spend those things. It will give you a clear indication on whether or not the pursuit of pleasure is your ultimate goal. We can learn from the younger brother that in the end, who knows how long that end is, who knows when that's coming, but in the end, it just simply doesn't pay off. Doesn't pay off. The second thing we learn through this text is this, that control is an illusion. Control is an illusion. See, the younger brother, he left home because he wanted control of his own life. Like, clearly, he was tired of his dad's control over him. I want to get out from underneath your control. I want to do this on my own. And most of us can relate to his position or his posture, can't we? Have you ever said things like this? I can't wait till I move out. I don't know how many times I said that growing up. Like, I just could not wait to get out from underneath my dad's roof. Like, I want to do this all on my own. One of the silliest things that I could not wait to do when I got out on my own was I was going to make a full batch of cake batter. I wasn't going to bake the cake. I was going to eat it as batter. Because I couldn't do that in my house, but I wanted to do it. So, I mean, how many of you guys love cake batter? Oh, yeah. I never did, by the way. But I couldn't wait to do that because in our house there was a rule you couldn't do that, but I wanted to do it so badly. Like, we can all relate. Just can't wait till I move out. Or how about this? I can't wait till I have my own crew. Maybe you're in the trades and you're just thinking to yourself, man, I'm so tired of working for that supervisor. I can't wait till I'm a supervisor and I get to call the shots. Or how about this? I can't wait till I'm my own boss. Once I'm my own boss, I won't have to answer to anybody, right? Because I want complete control of my life. Listen, friends. Control, no matter how bad we want it, it is an absolute illusion. We cannot control anything. And sometimes our control isn't so blatant. Sometimes it's more subtle approach, also known as manipulation. It's still control. You're just controlling behind the scenes, trying to manipulate things so that you have ultimate control. The game is still the same. It is all about control. And control is an illusion because 99.9% of our lives are out of our control. And I think it's generous to say that there's even 0.1% that's in our control. Just control is simply, it is unattainable. We can't control any of it. And we see this because about the time his money ran out, a great famine swept over the land. You see, This younger brother, he had a plan and he thought he was in control and he thought he was gonna get everything that he wanted and all the promises were gonna pay off in the end. And then the great famine swept over the land. We are all one phone call, one diagnosis, one downturn in the market, one pink slip away from being completely out of control in our life. And if we spent our whole lives in pursuit of control, hoping it was going to pay off in the end, if all of life's happiness and all of life's contentment rests on you being in control, what happens when you recognize all of life is out of your control? What then? Anxiety? Anger? Worry? Like, these are the kinds of emotions that settle in. Why? Because control can never pay off. It is just simply an illusion. The younger brother found that out in grand fashion when he's feeding pigs, the animal he should have never even been in contact with. And while feeding them, he thought to himself, what they're eating actually looks pretty tasty. I have never once fed my dogs. Well, maybe when I was a little kid, I may have eaten dog food when I was little, I don't know. But since I've been a rational human being, I've never once been feeding one of our animals and thought to myself, I would love to have some of that. You have to be at a pretty low place for you to begin to think that I want to eat what the pigs are eating. So when you recognize that life is out of control, what happens then? That's why I'm grateful that this parable doesn't leave us hanging for too long. It answers the question. It tells us and it shows us our third point is that Jesus provides where other promises fail. This has been our driving focus for this series and it will continue into next week as well. Jesus provides where other promises fail. See, all other promises, they rely on you. You're the payment. How you perform determines your success or your failure, but not so with the gospel. And we see this so clearly because when the younger brother comes to his senses and he thinks to himself that even my dad's servants are eating better, they have more than enough, why am I here? Like wallowing in pig mire when I could go back home and try to talk my dad into letting me be just a simple hired hand. If I could just go home, I could be a hired hand, and then maybe I could work my way back into the family. You see, the younger brother is going from a self-discovery mode into a moral conformity mode. He's like, what I did wrong in self-discovery, I want to make it right, and I'm going to go back to my dad, and I'm going to pitch this idea to him. Here's the idea. Can I work for you? Because if I work for you, I could pay off all of my debt, and then maybe I could become a son. So that's what he does. He works up a speech. He goes back to be with the father, right? This is what the speech is. I've sinned against heaven, and I've sinned against you. I am not worthy to be called a son. Would you please hire me on as a hired hand and I could pay my debt off. And so many of us, when we come to Christ, that's the deal we try to make, isn't it? I know that I've sinned. I know that I've blown it. If I can just do enough right, maybe I can outweigh all the bad that I've done. And this is the conversation that the young brother has worked up. He's rehearsed this probably 1,000 times on his way back home. And this is what he's met with instead. 15, verse 20. So he returned home to his father. And while he was still a long way off, his father saw him coming, filled with love and compassion. He ran to his son. He embraced him and he kissed him. His son said to him, Father, I have sinned against both heaven and you. And I'm no longer worthy of being called your son. And remember, he's going to go on to say, could I be one of your hired servants? But he doesn't get it out of his mouth because the father cuts him off. His father cuts him off. It says this, but his father said to the servants, quick, bring the finest robe in the house. Put it on him, get a ring for his finger, sandals for his feet, and kill the calf we've been fattening. We must celebrate with a feast, for this son of mine was dead and he has returned to life. He was lost, but now he is found. So the party begins. See, Jesus provides where other promises fail. Our God comes running after us. Why? Because he's full of compassion. And we try to work it off the debt. And he says, no, I'll have none of that. You cannot work off this debt. But what you can do is you can wear the robe, you can wear the ring, and you can wear the sandals. And all of that declares that you are a son. You are a daughter. In one short little paragraph, we recognize that Jesus provides where all other promises fail. Because in the gospel story, the true gospel, humans don't pay. God does. God pays by crawling up on a cross for us. If we could have the worship team come. And in all of this, we recognize that our badness doesn't keep us out. Why? Because Jesus invites us in. Our badness doesn't keep us out because Jesus invites us in. And I love this paragraph, again, in the book Prodigal God. Timothy Keller says this. He says, God's love and forgiveness can pardon and restore any and every kind of sin or wrongdoing. Let that settle in. Any kind of sin or wrongdoing, God can pardon and restore it. Says it doesn't matter who you are or what you've done. There is no evil that the Father's love cannot pardon and cover. There is no sin that is a match for his grace. Friends, that is the gospel. That is the good news. There is no sin that is a match for God's grace. Would you stand to your feet this morning as we begin to close? And I have two takeaways. The first takeaway coming out of this message is this. Have you been trying to find happiness and contentment through self-discovery? I hope you heard loud and clear that Jesus provides where other promises fail. And my hope is that your next step is to receive his invitation into relationship with him. Receive Jesus' invitation into relationship with him. Abandon the self-discovery pursuit and surrender yourself to Jesus. Whatever you've done in the past, friend, it is not too much. Jesus can pardon every sin. Second takeaway is this. For those of us who have surrendered to Jesus, we're in pursuit of him. We're sons and daughters. We recognize God's love and compassion for us, and it changed our lives. Now it's time for us to join God in his pursuit of the irreligious, to get our eyes up and focus on the world around us that need to hear this message of God's love and his forgiveness and his grace. So our takeaway, if we're followers of Jesus, is to join him in his pursuit of the irreligious. I'm going to pray. The band's going to play. And it's a great time for us to process. And as you process, maybe you want some prayer this morning. We're gonna have friends down here that would love to pray with you before you leave. Maybe you're ready to step across the line of faith. I encourage you, come down here. I'll be down here in the front row. Come up to me. I would love to talk with you about what it looks like to surrender your life to Jesus. So Father, thank you for your word. Thank you for the way that it challenges us. Now help us to live it out in the lives that we live moving forward. In your name.
Thanks for tuning in. This concludes today's message. New sermon podcasts are uploaded by Tuesday of each week. We'd also love to invite you to our live gatherings each Sunday at 10 a.m. Our gatherings are also streamed live on YouTube and Facebook each week. On behalf of the Canvas Church team, we hope you have a great week, and we'll catch you next time.